It's Thursday, July 24th, 2025. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and it ran wild. Scientists and epidemiologists peg its beginnings to the 80s, but it has now been silenced. I speak, of course, of Hulkamania.
Everybody knows that Hulkamania is the strongest force in this universe.
And with so many conditions said to be eradicated, it could come back. You'd have to ask our current HHS secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who also, like the now late Hulk Hogan, spoke at the Republican convention. But Hulkamania and the Hulkamaniacs mourn. Hulk Hogan, 80s icon, 90s heel, aughts scourge of Gawker, and for a while there, lover of Mrs. the Love Sponge. As I said, RNC speaker has died. Let us all rend our garments from the front, tearing them away, exposing very well-developed pecs in a moment of appreciation. Okay, that moment now done. Mark Raimondi, who wrote a book called Say Hello to the Bad Guys, will be on the show on Monday. And one of the bad guys was Hulk Hogan. As I said, he turned heel for a breakaway rival to the WWE, first F, then E. So we get into wrestling and how wrestling informs politics. You've heard about this, but I'm going to teach you some phrases like a shoot that turns into a work. You'll know what that means. So today on this show, it's a not even mad day. And I want to tell you a little bit about the guests. Although over on the Not Even Mad feed, if you subscribe directly, there are bonus segments where you get to know Jesse Adams and Z. Cohen Sanchez a little bit more. We talk about Jesse's sort of political transformation from a Bernie guy to someone who now writes for the Washington Examiner. And why I want you to subscribe to the Not Even Mad feed, which isn't any sort of additional charge or anything, is we want to get that feed with so robust an audience that we could take Not Even Mad off of this feed and have more programming for everyone. I'll do a show there, and then we can have more programming here, but it has to get up to a certain threshold. So it's a good show, and you should recommend it to people, but I also thank you for subscribing and listening there. Here, you will find Z. Cohen Sanchez. She was on the show a couple of weeks ago. She also has an interesting story. She worked as a Bernie Sanders staffer, and then she, you might remember her a couple weeks back, wanted to have an organization that challenged Charlie Kirk directly. She did. She just went, and she's going to talk about some of the things that happened there. She just went to a Charlie Kirk event, and she had some bros there trying to debate him, and I think a bunch of people got kicked out, but it worked very well. So Z is someone staunchly and firmly on the left, but also very much wants to communicate effectively so Democrats win elections. Jesse Adams writes on Substack as the Ivy Exile, and he writes for the Washington Examiner, a very useful publication. They do good work. They're a conservative publication. You will find, and Jesse talks about on the Not Even Mad feed, but I will tell you, he is mostly an apostate to the liberal or progressive movement over the issue of immigration. It's Not Even Mad.
If you want to be a Hulkamaniac, I can sure tell you how to stay on track. You gotta train, say your prayers, eat your vitamins too. These are all the things that the maniacs do. Positive thoughts and positive deeds. These are the things that make you succeed. Always be good to your family and friends. They're the only ones that'll be there in the end.
Hello and welcome back to Not Even Mad, the show where we do for the divisions in American politics what Chris Martin undid for the marriage of two New Englanders. Today we speak of public media funding, immigration, and Epstein, Jeffrey, not Juan. We do so as we uphold our reputation for refutation, and we vow to be Not Even Mad. We, I say we. Who are we? We, in this case, is Z, Z Cohen Sanchez, executive director of National Ground Game and founder of the Unfuck America Tour. Z, are we unfucked yet? Is it a binary? Is it, or are there gradations of fuckitude that you're keeping track of?
There aren't fuck gradations, I would say that. But the answer in short is no, we are not unfucked. So we are still going.
So is there a countdown clock, like the nuclear clock, to see when?
How many minutes are we till midnight and hours to unfucked? More unfucked if we get rid of Trump in 2028 and if we win back the House and the Senate in the midterms.
Now, Jesse Adams might disagree. He writes for the Washington Examiner and is the writer, editor, and consultant behind the Ivy Exile on Substack, where I found him. Hey, Jesse, thanks for doing this. Am I like violating your secret identity by merging your name and the Ivy Exile title?
To some extent, but the Ivy Exile was kind of a gimmick that was inspired by the old TV show The Fugitive. And I knew I couldn't stay anonymous forever. So the New York Post outed me when they reprinted the second thing I ever published. So,
which was what?
It was a piece reflecting on my couple of years working for Columbia Journalism School and covering the Pulitzer Prizes and gradually becoming disillusioned about the Pulitzer Prizes. So the New York Post ate that right up.
Interesting. Were you there during the 1619 prize and that designation?
No, that was a little after my time. I was there 2011 through 2013. So I attended some of the Pulitzer luncheons, but it was all about the Arab Spring at that time.
Yes, well, that went well for everyone. Checks, notes.
Sure
no
did.
One. Jeffrey Epstein committed sexual assault, financial shenanigans, and suicide. There I said it. He has also committed a deep sin in the world of Trump loyalists. Well, some of those things may be true to the Trump loyalists, but what he has done is he has reflected indignity on Donald Trump. I'll give you some of the latest polling. In America, 63% disapprove of Trump's handling of the Epstein files. 20% are undecided. 70% of all registered voters approve of how the administration dealt with the Epstein files. Approve. I understand undecided. They think 17% think they did a bang up job. Mike Johnson shut down the House to avoid a vote on Epstein. I guess 17% thought that was good. Now, let's just look among Republicans. 40% approve of the president's handling and 36% disapprove. And you don't get those numbers. I even saw a poll that said there was more disapproval than approval among Republicans over Epstein. And I'm interested in that. And the rest of the media is interested in that. And MSNBC and Senator Dick Durbin and the Bulwark were pretty much salivating over that. This could be the thing to split the coalition. And yet, none of this seems to have actually happened as of this recording. This third rail was like a bug zapper, maybe. So, Z, I ask you, as a close personal confidant of Charlie Kirk, who is a huge Epstein truther, tell me, you were at an event with Charlie Kirk. What's your opinion of what that faction or whatever factions of the Trump coalition were thinking and saying about the need for Trump to get to the bottom of Epstein?
Yeah, so it was interesting because Charlie's event, the Student Action Summit, which is one of his biggest events of the year, happened the day after Charlie like completely went pro-Trump on the Epstein stuff, which
right. So there was a day of we got to get to Epstein, and then the next day he said I'm not talking about this anymore. He since has started talking a bit more about it, but
yeah.
The event where Unfuck debated Kirk was right after he backed off. You're saying.
Yeah, so he basically, so the Student Action Summit, he had come out with a TikTok media stuff basically saying, right, that we need to stop talking about the Epstein files. I mean, really like in lockstep with exactly what Trump told him to do. And I think that his audience just didn't, for one of the first times, just like didn't buy it. Because when we were inside the event, especially the day, that first day, I only lasted in there 2 hours before security took me out. I wasn't doing anything, I swear. I was just walking around. The people that we talked to were just not, like, there was definitely sort of a break in trust there. And I don't think it was enough of a break in trust where people were even entertaining the idea of potentially leaving Trump. But definitely, like, I would say stronger than disappointment, like maybe even like bordering anger a little bit. And then Charlie, I think it was that night or maybe it was the following day, had a conversation with, I can't remember who it was, but one of the, like, you know, leading political right-wing figures, and essentially flipped his position on it, right? And so then this air sort of was a little bit more stable, I think, because people were like, okay, well, you know, at least Charlie is, you know, fighting for us, whatever the hell that means. But still, I think that there is that distrust that still exists, at least amongst like a small percentage of them.
Yeah. Jesse, what's your look back and when it first broke and we started seeing this polling, this could really be the thing that erodes Trump's base. Were you buying that at all?
Not especially. I mean, I think Trump, part of his impressive turnout is engaging with low information voters who don't always participate in the process. And I think a lot of those people, it almost reminds me of when people tell stories of, oh, the Beatles went psychedelic because Bob Dylan introduced them to weed. Well, no, that's not what had happened, but it makes sense to a lot of people. And so I think in the first Trump term, when you had QAnon and Pizzagate, and, well, why isn't John Roberts voting the way we want him to? Well, it couldn't be that he's an establishmentarian who became Chief Justice because that's just who he is. No, he's a pedo, and they have something on him, and that's why everything's not falling perfectly into place. So I do think there's a chunk of his base that giving up on the Epstein files is sort of giving up on the Code of Hammurabi or something, just this basic foundational element of their worldview. But at the end of the day, they don't have anywhere to go, and the Democrats aren't really providing an alternative that those sorts of voters are interested in. And so I thought it was probably going to be a tempest in a teapot at the end of the day.
So it is good for Trump that he brought these low information voters in. The nice way to say that is people work two jobs and, you know, have seven kids and can't pay attention. You compliment them a little bit. But it's great for him. They were just on the sidelines. And if you bring them in through a narrative and the narrative doesn't rely on you even understanding the word establishmentarian, which apparently I don't either, all the better. But what happens is, I think the people who are high information, not even voters, people in the media, trying to analyze this, it's very hard to put your mind in the mindset of people you don't understand. And I don't want to blame the media too much about getting this wrong, and they may get it right. But it did strike me, did it strike you, Z, that the makers of sense did buy that this would break the cult of Trump in a way that nothing has ever broken the cult of Trump, and yet they always seem to fall for it?
I mean, honestly, I think that this is the closest we've ever been to that. I would argue that. I can't think, unless there's an argument to present otherwise, I don't think that there is anything else that, I mean, Trump said it himself. They can go out to the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they'd still vote for him, right? So the fact that there was this thing that did break some trust, I think, is a good sign that maybe we are headed in the right direction in some way, that there are some things that aren't going to pass with his base. It's just the Epstein stuff is complicated because of what we were just talking about, right? Like this whole thing with like Pizzagate and the deep state, and it can very quickly sort of go into that. Right. So,
yeah, I think that's what it's very much about. I think that's the core of it.
It is. But at the same time, is there stuff on Jeffrey Epstein that people should know about? Probably. I'd argue.
Right. But the core of what I'm saying is the core of the appeal to the Trump voter who he brought in is that first thing, not the reasonable, rational, this guy had clients and this guy abused people and let's find out who they are. Yeah.
That I'd agree with. That's why it gets so complicated, because I think for the average, like, high information Democrat voter, they do want to know because of the fact that there is stuff probably there. But then we're sort of faced with this, like, shitty, almost anti-Semitic, deep state nonsense, you know?
As a counterpoint to that, though, I think there's a feeling among a lot of Trump supporters that if there was a smoking gun there, with all of the lawfare and with all of the efforts over the past 4 years to get him, well, the Biden people had access to that, and why wouldn't they have leaked about him if there was something there? So I'm not sure. I tend to think there are probably a lot of names on there that don't want to get out, and that both parties would have an interest in keeping it suppressed. But to the extent that Trump might be specifically implicated in a Prince Andrew sort of way, I don't see how that wouldn't have been leaked if they had it.
Well, maybe not, because, okay, maybe I'm way too naive or idealistic, but it would be a violation of DOJ policy. And Merrick Garland was a more or less by the book guy who constantly frustrated Biden by not being an explicitly political player. So I'm sure you agree, Z. Do you think that's too naive, Jesse?
Well, I would look at the abortion decision being leaked ahead of time. I would look at Mayorkas claiming, we'll talk about migration a little later, I know, but Mayorkas talking about migration being climate change driven versus changes mm-hmm. in the asylum policy. I don't tend to think
Democrats lied and Democrat officials lied. And there was a top Democrat who pretended he could do meetings past 4 o'clock at night. But my supposition with this is that it's just a little bit further to violate DOJ policy, which is not a guideline, but they take extremely seriously, and to go into a file where maybe Trump's name, and we saw one of the accusers raised, I mean, she told the media this, so she raised in an official interview, her last name is Farmer, she raised in an interview that guys like Donald Trump were always around. Now, I don't think we saw that leak beforehand, and the fact that that was out there, it seems like the sort of thing that could be leaked if they were breaking the rules, but you know, again, my theory is they were loath to break the rules, even on this one. I don't know, Z, what do you think?
I get scared getting into this territory because I feel like it can very easily fall into conspiracy, right? Because part of me agrees with Destiny, with Steven on this, right? Of like, sure, if there, like, there's more chance that there wasn't a list during that time, or that there's not a list at all, because the chances of it not getting leaked are so low, right? Like, that's where I sort of am like, that's why when we were messaging, I was like, I don't know if I have a strong opinion on this, because to me, the likelihood, like, I try to think statistically, right? Like, what are the odds that this wouldn't get leaked, right? And then I start to think, oh, like, you know, and that's where it scares me, because then it gets sort of into the conspiracy theories of, like, I start to think of Alex Jones and I start to think of Sandy Hook, and like how you can easily fall down the rabbit hole of how many people would have to be involved in this, like, conspiracy in order for it to be real, right? Like, all the firefighters would have to, all the people in the town would have to. And then I think the same thing for the Epstein stuff on this side, right? And so that's where my opinion gets shaky.
Got it. So we've established that I'm an establishmentarian dupe. I'm going to say establishmentarian a few times. But the Epstein part of Trump's approval is a factor in the fact that his approval rating has hit a new low. As of this recording, 43.5% of Americans approve of the job he's doing. 53.8% disapprove, and he has taken a big hit on migration. CNN conducted a poll showing that the president has 42% approval on immigration and 58% disapproval. I mean, there were, for most of his presidency this time, he had more approval than disapproval on immigration. And if you just look at who approves and doesn't approve, well, I'll read a poll question from CBS. Do you approve or disapprove the way Donald Trump administration is using detention facilities? Guess what? 93% of Democrats disapprove, 85% of Republicans approve, but the independents are a literal 2-to-1 ratio of opposing it. Do you think, Jesse, because immigration is a driving factor with you, do you think that the public is where they tell pollsters they are, that we disapprove of how he's doing it? Or do you think that they disapprove of that he's doing it, that there is no real way to do it without images of sympathetic seeming immigrants getting rounded up and they don't want to see those images?
I think Americans are used to the media telling them that they can have their cake and eat it too. And so I think Americans both want to be really tough on what's perceived as wrongdoers or maybe people who just arrived very recently without any roots here. But then they also want, you know, very cheap chicken nuggets coming out of these giant poultry farms in Arkansas or Tennessee. And so I think a lot of it's a matter of emphasis, what's on the news, and if people are feeling alarmed. And the flow under Biden was so high. And I think the context that gets missed a lot of the time is affirmative action was still around and wokeness was still at its peak. And so I think to a lot of Americans, it was looking like we're getting in this incredible number of people, and then they're also going to have certain legal advantages in the system over many Americans who are already here. So I think with wokeness in remission and with affirmative action off the table, at least we'll see how much silent resistance there is to the Supreme Court ruling. But I think that made migration a lot less salient to people, and they're feeling less under siege now. So I think there's more room for compassion or, hey, I only wanted that gangbanger. I didn't want the, you know, the nice person who giving me the Uber ride.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't considered that, the combination of wokeness or entering a period of peak woke maybe convinces people that even though the immigration numbers are extremely high, don't worry, or we'll still be able as a country to have sensible rules about what we give the immigrants, something like that. But I mean, I just think, and Z, you're a political realist, the president, Trump, did have a mandate to do a lot on immigration, right? To reverse the legal and illegal immigrants that came during the Biden term, most of them illegal. So was it, to get back to the question, do you think, though, that because he's Trump and he always does everything, not with an axe instead of a scalpel, but with a, a blunderbuss and a catapult, do you think that is that what they're telling pollsters is why they object so much to immigration? Or was it maybe what Jesse was saying?
You know, it's hard to say, but like, I think what we're going to what's really going to determine how people feel about it is when we get to the midterm elections, how many people mm-hmm. is actually deported. And my guess on this is that he's not going to deport very many people at all because of the way that he's doing it. And because of his strategy, I don't think that they're going to see enough of an increase now. Is that going to affect the average low information voter that doesn't really track things like that? I don't know. But what I do know is that it's going to make its rounds on social media regardless. And that's where a lot of these low information voters are living and breathing and spending their time. So I think that that part's going to be determined. I do know that, well, I think at least that this was a big issue with the wall, right? Because mm-hmm. he spent so much time talking about the wall. We're going to build the wall. Mexico's going to pay for the wall, all of that. And then how much of the wall got built? Like an eighth, maybe? And then they like went way over budget with it from what they said. And he was able to get his base off of that, which I think was really interesting. But I don't know if they're going to be there with immigration because I think he spent a lot more time on the deportation factor.
Do you think deportation will be certainly more important to voters than the border statistics? If you go with some of these polls say that they don't like his deportation policies, they don't like the idea of taking innocent people and deporting them, of course. But on border security, he still does pretty good.
Yeah, on the border security factor, I think so. But I do think that people are going to want to see some tangible evidence in terms of people being deported. I mean, don't you got like, I mean, you'd think.
Well, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I think if Trump, he's made some trial balloons in recent weeks about, well, maybe we won't go after agricultural people. Maybe we won't go after certain kinds of people in the poultry plants and that sort of thing. And I think when you get to the real border hawks, that's an issue, because Trump has to think about if the price of chicken nuggets goes up, how much core support is he going to lose? But the people who are really motivated on this issue want the prices of chicken nuggets to go up, because they think that'll be reflected in people's wages. So it's I don't think Trump is going to be able to keep the real border hawk part of his coalition happy with just to avoid some pretty adverse consequences to the economy. But if he's not having a pretty consistent flow of mean-looking people who he can show photographs of at Alligator Alcatraz or being shackled onto a plane or something, like, it, the gravity will catch up with him eventually, I think.
Do you think his theory of the case, to look tough, to have Kristi Noem pose in front of detainees wearing her athleisure at CECOT, to perhaps give the image that the cruelty is the point and lean into that, to maybe do a couple things to appease his border hawk base, but also to give the message that we're being tough on immigration? Do you think his theory of the case is and will work out for him politically?
I think basically there's an element to which the messaging is both to his base to look, we're being tough, but also to the rest of the planet, because so many of the, I want to push back a little bit on, you had said the majority of the millions who came were illegal. And, well, they weren't. They were allowed in as their asylum case is adjudicated. And the fact that that takes years, and that most of those cases will be denied, and that then most of those people would opt to stay and risk deportation rather than leaving themselves, all of those people still have contacts back in their home countries. So every single one of the millions who came with the dubious asylum story and were able to get semi-permanent or at least long-term U.S. residency, well, they're telling everyone back home, you know, come, this worked for me, you can do it too. So that creates an enormous magnet. And there's an extent to which a lot of this messaging and the over-the-top inhumanity of some of it is really, I think, to discourage that magnet factor, because there are a lot of people talking to their loved ones on the iPhone, seeing how much better their life would be if they could somehow get here.
Do you think the Democrats have a better issue, or just where, not Trump?
I think Democrats, I think Mayorkas under Biden was so disingenuous, and there was all this messaging about, we're doing all we can, we need new legislation, we're at the limits of what we can do with our executive powers. And then a couple of months before the election, when it becomes clear they're not going to get the comprehensive reform, well, all of a sudden they changed their application of asylum rules, like critics had been asking, and largely solved the problem of their own accord. And so I think that cost years and years of credibility. I think it's going to take a very long time before Democrats can dig themselves out of that.
Do you think the Democrats have a better message on immigration, or is it just, we're not Trump?
It's just, I mean, we're not. Well, this is what I will give Kamala Harris. I think that it was smart for her to be tough on the border. And I'm glad that she did that, because, and this sort of goes into a question I had as well about, it would be interesting to see how many Trump supporters are actual border hawks versus the people that just care about this tough on crime messaging, right? I would venture to say the border hawks are probably a very small percentage. I don't have any stats to back that up. That would just be from like what I've seen online, from talking to Trump supporters. I don't think that there are people that are pouring through legislation and trying to figure out how to make the border stronger. But I do think that the Democrats have been at least decent in their messaging, or at least decent in their stance on, everybody here agrees that we need to have strong borders. There's no argument against that. And I think that that's a good thing, because I think if we went with this sort of open border policy, I think we would just lose in a landslide just based off of that issue alone.
I hear you in terms of the rhetoric that a lot of the more establishment Democrats are using. But when you look at the online discourse or progressive thought leadership, or where a lot of the energy of the party is now, whether it's AOC or Mamdani or wherever, you still see quite a bit of no human is illegal, abolish ICE. I don't think that the Democratic constituencies have really particularly changed their mind. And I think with Trump being so rah-rah on the border, it's certainly my impression that today's Democrats are closer to open borders than not.
Yeah, I mean, to me, abolish ICE is sort of as salient a message as stop Taylor Swift or be against pumpkin spice. I mean, have you seen the funding levels of ICE? It's going to be, I mean, yes, some of it will be to build facilities, which is not an ongoing funding level, but it's now the biggest federal law enforcement agency if not by number of people working there, certainly by money. ICE is not being abolished, people. ICE is advancing.
But what is so interesting about like Zohran and AOC, for example, is that you would think that in New York City, a city that we've polled time and time again, where safety is the biggest concern, right? That is the number one concern of New Yorkers, is safety. And yet having immigrants come into this country illegally almost not arguably can mean that safety is in a position of vulnerability, right? Or at least that's the messaging around it. I don't personally believe that, but that's the messaging around it. So then why is it that Zohran and AOC are winning by landslides, right? I mean, AIPAC has tried to get AOC out. It's, at this point, I would think almost impossible. She has such a stronghold on the district. In her first election, she won not only District 14, but she ran and won in a write-in campaign in District 15 as well, right? All while, and I know she softened her messaging around abolish ICE.
She can't serve both.
I know she can't, right? And she didn't, but the whole
she
point
live
is that
in both.
District 15,
I know New York State.
Right?
I know crazy New York State law says if you just have visited a district or think nicely about it, you could run. But yeah, it's crazy.
But District 15 is so interesting because everybody might argue against me and say, okay, well, it's easy to win District 14 because, oh, well, she just got the white vote in Queens, right? I hear that all the time. Well, she just got the white. And there's an argument to be made because, yeah, she did worse in the Bronx, right, where there's majority black voters. But District 15 is not laid out like that at all. I mean, District 15 is majority people of color. A lot of it is uptown, right? And so to me, it's like, okay, well, she ran on that and she still won by a landslide and also won the neighboring district. And then Mamdani, who ran on similar messaging, also won the New York City mayoral primary. So it's just interesting that there is sort of that dichotomy between abolish ICE and then the safety, which we know is the number one issue in New York City amongst voters.
Yeah. Which might change, given that this year is tracking to be the least murderous in New York City history. Which really does show that policies, I do think policies have an effect, but the bigger winds of both demographic and societal change are enormous. It's a little like why the Beatles started doing drugs. It wasn't just one cause, multifactorial, overdetermined. We'll be back in a minute to talk about a place that two of the three of us gave a paycheck to. This is public broadcasting. Try to guess which two. Back in a minute on Not Even Mad. And we are back with Not Even Mad. I am joined by Zee Cohen and Jesse Adams. And let's talk about the rescinding, hasn't been done in 25 years, of funds for, well, $7 billion in foreign aid and $1.1 billion that was to go to PBS and NPR now will not go to them. I have written and talked a lot on the subject. And my thesis is, I do understand why anyone this side of a pretty leftist person would hear a lot of NPR programming and say, that's not for me. However, Jesse Adams is on this side of a non-leftist person. And Jesse, what's your take? And tell us your history, too.
So I started my career working for Bill Moyers on PBS. I was his blogger and then his research assistant. And I'd grown up on PBS. I mean, no other network did I watch more. And I mean, it really shaped me as a person. And I still watch a fair amount of PBS. But why? Now, RIP Bill Moyers, he was a wonderful man. I have absolutely nothing negative to say to him or say about him as a human being. I did feel about the show, though, and I worked there during the transition from Bush to Obama, that we were biased, and especially with the Obama movement and the excitement for him that perhaps was driven by the rise of social media, but there was still so much of the legacy media that was sort of reflecting that. Just a lot of people interpreted Obama as a fundamental generational change that everybody was going along with, more than maybe the actual topography on the scene was. So, but certainly our office was kind of head over heels for Obama, and we had a lot of programming that just, if I weren't on that page, just frankly is not appropriate for public funding. Now, our show happened to be fully privately
funded.
Was
this Bill Moyers Journal? Was that the show?
Yeah, this was Bill Moyers Journal. I was there from 2007 to 2010.
See, I'll get to you in a second. I do have to ask you, though, Jesse, was this time in your life before you had intellectually gone more conservative? And how did you think about the bias and the fact that you were on a public broadcaster then?
So I had been in college on the executive board of the College Dems, and I'd ended up publicly resigning, and it was largely over the immigration issue. But when I moved to New York to work for Bill Moyers, I still saw myself entirely as a progressive, just more in kind of the labor movement, sort of union, higher wages for ordinary people, sort of progressive. And there seemed to be less and less room for that during the Obama era. So over the course of seeing how the campaign worked out, it was instrumental in me, I would say, moving to the center more than moving to the to the right in particular.
Okay. Yeah, sorry if I mischaracterized you. But so then how did you process the fact that you were on this show, granted privately funded, but the P in public broadcasting? Did you say this is wrong? Did you say this should be reformed? Did you say that, did you have different ideas about if the media can be unbiased? What did you think about that at the
time? At the time, I was very troubled and kind of torn between my personal respect and affection for Bill Moyers and just my sense that this isn't something that the public should be funding. So I, over the course of some years, came to the conclusion that public broadcasting just attracts a certain kind of idealistic person, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I do think that I no longer believe that public broadcasting is capable of doing unbiased news. So I had written an op-ed a couple of months ago that was arguing the best way to save PBS would be to spin the news hour and Frontline and the news programming off to cable or syndication and stick exclusively to documentaries and cultural programming and Antiques Roadshow, that kind of thing.
And Daniel Tiger, which is, and Sesame Street, which is usually what had saved PBS in the past. Z, tell me about the, I don't know how much you followed it, but the messaging to try to save these broadcasters. It used to work. I called it the Big Bird Shield, right? Mitt Romney expressed an opinion I think PBS should be canceled. Then they say, you don't like Big Bird? And Mitt Romney, a different kind of decent person, would say, no, I like Big Bird. Didn't work this time. Totally different era. I think PBS, NPR especially, was still playing in that old, oh, people will be ashamed to get crosswise with Cookie Monster. But what do you think of the messaging?
Yeah, I think that was largely the messaging, which I think to this base is much harder because we're not in the Obama era anymore, right? So I think that it's really... And if you ask, like, how to shift the messaging, I really don't know. Because I think when it comes to really any issue that Trump stands strong on, it's hard to get his base to go against him on anything, you know? And so that's a...
Right.
You know... Yeah.
And it's hard to get anyone in the Senate or the House to do it. And if they do, it's not going to be on PBS. That's not going to be the thing they break with him. Yeah.
A real challenge for that campaign also was it's true what they would say, that PBS and NPR are most significant in rural areas. If you're in an urban area, you're going to have competition. There's other sources. There are people who are interested. But if you're in the middle of Missouri, what are your options for seeing an opera or something? I mean, PBS can really play a major role in connecting people to the world. But then how do you communicate that and say, oh, well, those rural NPR listeners, oh, they're the ones who want to hear about, you know, everything being racist and sexist and all the rest of it. And so it's a completely legitimate argument, but it's an argument that when people try to make, it's easy to spin it off as you're just being arrogant or there are no rural people who want to listen to that. And there certainly are.
Right. And I would also say you have to give us $1 billion because we occasionally can give you an early warning on a natural disaster that you wouldn't have gotten, although that seems not to have been the case in the recent floods. Or you have to give us $1 billion so we can give opera to people in rural Missouri. There seems a much better, more efficient way. If it's really about the opera to rural Missouri project, you could do that for a lot less than $1 billion. I would... have definitely voted to support my former employer. I just think in terms of government funding, is it more good than bad? Yes, it's a lot more good than bad. Should you use taxpayer dollars to fund things that make America better? Yes, that's what you should do. Well, could private industry replicate that? No, because look at rural Missouri Opera, but also look at the entire state of the news business that just tries to make a profit. Couple of them can, and then they close everywhere else. So you add it all up, I would definitely have voted to fund them, but I could see the point of the people who criticize them, and NPR did itself no favors, and NPR did PBS no favors, because the NPR stories that John Kennedy, I wrote about this, but critics can point to, you go down a list of eye-rolling, calling country music racist, saying that we need to decolonize bird watching. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of stories, to say nothing of the Hunter Biden laptop, to say nothing of a lot of their trans coverage, that were eye-rolly, that weren't serving all America. And then when I looked at the criticism of PBS, it was mostly that the NewsHour uses the phrase right wing more than left wing, but they do it because they cover January 6th extensively and QAnon. And when you're talking about Kevin McCarthy, what portions of his coalition were voting against him? It was the far right or the far right wing. So I do think that's another point. I do think that PBS really got screwed by NPR. And I think that NPR had a lot of excess, but I don't think it was justified their defunding. But that's how it goes. I mean, this is a theme of what we've been talking about. Trump always goes way too far. And I think in 2025, there is no way to ever mend it, not end it. We see that with the schools. We see that with immigration. We see it with PBS. I don't think that that's a viable solution in this administration or maybe in this culture. My two pessimistic.
I don't know. I think, like, honestly, it is now that I think about it more deeply, it is kind of surprising to me because a lot of these lower information voters obviously are lower income, right? So you would think that, at least for PBS, I can understand the NPR angle completely, right? But at least for PBS, it's surprising that there's not more, like, discourse about this online because of how much kids are relying on PBS, right? And I would argue not just in the rural communities. I mean, like, for example, like my husband grew up in the projects in New York City. They didn't have cable. Like, PBS was all they watched, right? Like, there literally wasn't anything else to watch other than PBS. So it really is like an equalizer, especially for kids that don't have access to cable or access to other ways to access that kind of information. But it doesn't seem to have, again, I think it's just because his base is just whatever Trump says goes, whatever his colleagues say goes. But it is interesting. I'd wonder, like, what happens if it actually does end up completely off the air? Is there going to be any pushback to that from his base?
Well, I do think there'll be a PBS. I was just on a local show where the station managers detailed what percentage of their budget is being hit by this cut. And my God, this was in Illinois, so not in Chicago, places like Pawnee, Illinois, and Normal, Illinois. We got callers from each of those places. And they're talking about 50% of their budgets. So they'll still be a PBS, and WNET in New York will continue on, and the Bill Moyer Show or the equivalent of that will continue on. But yeah, it is actually going to be a hit. And last thought on this. Jesse, if you wanted to say anything, I just have one.
Oh, I just wanted. It's such a self-inflicted tragedy with NPR in particular, because you go back 20 years, it was universally respected. I mean, even a lot of hardcore conservatives would listen to NPR because there was nothing like it, and it was so good. And a theme I come back to again and again in my writing is I think so many Democrats thought with Obama's comfortable reelection that that meant a permanent majority, that so many institutions just moved into victory mode. One of my commenters...
the question is settled. That was the sort of mindset. Okay.
Now we have a referendum. So NPR just destroyed its own credibility and made itself irrelevant to so many of its former fans, which if you're a progressive, as most people at NPR are, and you're trying to get your ideas into the national bloodstream, they made NPR a lot less effective at that. And it's just, it didn't have to happen. And so many critics begged them to change their ways, and they just wouldn't.
Yeah. And my last thought, final thoughts, to quote a great non-public radio broadcaster, if you know the history of CPB, without Bill Moyers, there would be no PBS. And now that the world is without Bill Moyers, for many parts of the country, there will be no more PBS. Sigh. Let's go on to our goat grinders. These are the things that grind our gears or get our goats. They could be little annoyances. They could be big annoyances. I'll let you take it where you will, Z. Cohen Sanchez.
My biggest pet peeve this week is...
goat grinder.
Oh, sorry, goat grinder. is the fact that Charlie Kirk is consistently still on his messaging about the fact that there should be a free marketplace of ideas, and yet doesn't let Democrats into any Turning Point USA events anymore.
So, do you have any proof of that? Any personal proof?
Yeah, well, we didn't get let in. But honestly, I thought actually it was just us that didn't get let in. So I was actually going to give Charlie a pass on that, because I was like, okay, well, you know, that's his decision, I guess. But no, we met several Democrats outside the event that were not with us, not associated, and actually not even... influencers either that had their
curious citizens,
you know, random people. Some of them were, I talked to one guy that was a teacher, talked to one person that was on social media. They just wanted to go in and just see like what was going on, and their tickets were canceled and refunded.
How'd they find out they were Democrats?
I don't know. There is a list that exists. That is what I've been told. There's a list of these people.
There's a list.
Yeah, I don't know how you get on the special list or what you have to do to get on said list, but there is a list. So,
yeah, I could see where that would grind your gears and get your goat. Jesse, what do you have as a goat grinder?
My goat grinder for this week would be, I keep seeing the word unhoused.
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. I had hoped with a focus on language in the Trump era that maybe we could leave that one in the past. And what my parents were both social workers. I'm very empathetic to the homeless. You know, I want them to be helped. But using the word unhoused sneaks in this kind of petty cosmology of this whole narrative that you're supposed to accept. I mean, unhoused, this person through no fault of their own, that's primarily due to the housing supply, has arrived in this situation, and it has nothing to do with high rates of mental illness or substance abuse or what have you. So a word like unhoused is a word like underserved, just any sort of term that implies you're going to accept this whole line of reasoning or you're a bad person.
Yes. Well, to stick up for marginalized linguists, I so agree with you. And don't you think that if we were starting from scratch, of the two, homeless or unhoused, the one that to me communicates more sympathy, the one that is less clinical is homeless. Like yeah. A home is a concept and an idea. And if someone is homeless, you might say, wow, a home's really important. But unhoused, it makes it seem like they're a cog in a factory, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like technically you can be unhoused living in an RV. Right? Like,
sure.
But an RV is still a home to many people, you know? So I'm going to back Jesse on that one, even if it gets me canceled. I am tired.
Well, everything gets you canceled, Zip.
I know, everything gets me. Well, this is going to be my cancel for the week, but I'm so tired of the policing. Because from a group of people that are apparently like ACAB, they love to police literally everybody and everything. That's my position.
Yeah, yeah. All cops are bastards, but all language cops are doing the Lord's work.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you're going to feel more human sympathy if somebody is experiencing hunger versus food insecurity. You know, just dump everything into this technocratic blender and put the expert with the graduate degree in charge, you know?
Yeah.
So my goat grinder is of the institution of the goat grinder itself. I got a little annoyed. I like to look at the goat grinders as clarion calls that exist throughout the universe. When someone puts forward a goat grinder, let that stand for all time and let everyone think about that and let that be a warning to future generations. So I look at goat grinders like some people might look at a mausoleum or a structure that is meant to stand the length of time. And yet last, not even mad, Jeff Maurer was on talking about his goat grinder, which is he is really annoyed at the excessive warnings of sawdust and its propensity to explode. Jeff Maurer has done a lot of work in construction, said, come on, you just got to be regular and not throw the sawdust in with oily rags and it's not going to explode. Then I was listening to Jeff on I Might Be Wrong, his Substack, his audio Substack, and this happened.
On the last wipe down of the floors before I did the stain, which you do with tack cloths to get every last bit of dust off because you don't want that to become part of the stain. I did that. I threw the rags, wet rags, in a Home Depot bucket. So now I've got wet sawdust covered rags in a confined space. The moisture is what leads to the microbes that can create a chemical reaction. The next thing I did is I stained the floor, wiping the stain off with these rags that aren't even rags like you'd think. They're more like glorified paper towels. They're pieces of paper now covered in flammable material. My dumbass threw those in the same bucket. And a few hours later, I'm walking by and thought, is someone barbecuing? And yes, someone was. That someone was me. And I feel a responsibility to say this because I wrote that. Oh, and then I went on Mike Pesca's podcast and told the same story about how, sawdust, you didn't have to be just right. Well, if you are as big of a dumbass as I am, and that takes a lot of doing, really, when I tell that story and hear myself say, so then I threw the oily rags on top of the sawdust in the same bucket, I do think, Jesus Christ, Maurer, you kind of deserve to have your house burned down. But just for the record, you can, in fact, cause sawdust to spontaneously ignite.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff, after going on this show, convincing the listeners not to be too upset with your sawdust exploding, had a case of sawdust explosion right there. It exploded in his face. So that, I'm sorry, Jeff. I'm glad you survived the great sawdust explosion of 25, but that is my goat grinder. But Godspeed. Godspeed, sir. Well, I want to thank my guest, Z. Cohen Sanchez, Executive Director of National Ground Game, and of course, the Unfuck America Tour, and Jesse Adams. And you can find him on Substack as the Ivy Exile and also in the Washington Examiner. And until next time, I'm not saying we're right. I'm not saying you're right. I am saying we're not even mad. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Astra Green is our social media director. The production coordinator is Ashley Kahn. Michelle Pesca is all there as our head of commissions on commissions. Oomperu, jeeperu, dooperu. And thanks for listening.